off the chart. He's just
like, who's my father?
But he was born to do, you know.
So are you gonna call it?
Well, you know, there's also the scale of it. On the biggest companies on our
I will come back from the Buck Clark.
I just like came back and hit the ground running with like this.
That's the bad thing about going on vacation. Nobody does your stuff and you get back.
I'm going to leave at 4 and be back at 7:45.
I used to do it if I could.
It and look at it.
Eliminate some.
As the co-sponsor?
It's just a few
of a colleague that I'm already beginning to mourn the loss of.
All right, we are going to come back from recess in 2 minutes. And we have video feed. Houston, or Apollo, this is Houston. We have video feed. So if everyone would take their seats. And if our runners, Director Inge, Bryant, did we notify folks standing outside? Okay, so the TVs are back on in our 3 overflow rooms, and we will pick up where we left off. And Commissioner Fritz had a question.
I have a question for Gail Pizzuto. You've just retired from the health department. Mm-hmm. My understanding is that under the Healthy Kids program, which is now available to all children, that dental checkups twice a year are available under the new under both of the plans that are available in Multnomah County. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So in addition or instead of whichever we decide on this outcome, I think it's very important for parents to know that they can sign up their children for the Healthy Kids program. Everybody is eligible for services in some manner or other, and that under the standard plan, there is dental coverage for children twice a year checkups. Is that correct?
For Healthy Kids, I'm not sure about this. When you say standard plan, are there kids that are on the standard plan now? I thought it was like the plus. Go ahead.
The Healthy Kids plan is...
Push the button.
Press that button.
Healthy,
you
hear me?
No.
You hit the
try right. It now. No, one more time.
Hello. Yeah. The Healthy Kids plan is for children...
Could you introduce yourself, please?
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Mike Plunkett. The Healthy Kids plan is for children that don't qualify for Oregon Health Plan and are in that range between qualifying a poverty income level and the children that actually have commercial insurance or can afford, you know, commercial insurance. And yes, that plan will cover basically the most comprehensive and robust plan that would occur under like SCHIP.
Right. So I want families watching to know that they don't have to worry about costs to go to the dentist in Multnomah County. In Multnomah County. Thank you very much. Sorry, please go on.
Their income eligibility requirements, the plans are also in flux because of the Oregon's share of the Tri-County, and there are also cuts at the federal level for Medicaid. So that is the answer of today, but there's quite a bit of retooling going on right now as well. So I just want to make sure that everyone knows that overlaying reality. Sir.
Yes, again, my name is Mike Plunkett, and I wear multiple hats in our community, advocating specifically for children that are on Oregon Health Plan or uninsured, low-income families in general. What I'd like to do in this testimony is speak to you from each one of those hats a little bit. I'm a public health dentist and the dental director for Neighborhood Health Center, which is a federally qualified health center. And in that role, we care for Oregon Health Plan and uninsured children and adults. And what we see in that environment, as do other providers who see Oregon Health Plan and low-income adults, and sometimes middle-income adults, is, you know, frequently we see a child that looks like either one of these children, and their hair is healthy, their skin is healthy, their eyes are healthy, they walk with a normal gait, otherwise they're fine. And then they open their mouths and we see this, what we call rampant, which means decay throughout the mouth. And there's abscesses. There are abscesses, which are infections in those teeth. There's chronic pain. If you look at the child on the bottom, you'll notice something that's not happening. Either one of these children, they're not smiling, because this is what the front teeth look like for the child on the bottom.
That's their actual teeth?
That's our teeth, yeah. Treated at OHSU. When we have once a year or twice a year clinics put on by the Oregon Dental Association and all the partners in the state and in other states, where access is an issue, we have up to 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 people, and probably 2 or 3 people that don't get in the doors because they can't make it there, that line up, spend a night in the cold and the rain to get in front of someone that has some knowledge about the delivery of dental care. And when David Satcher developed Healthy People 2010 in 1999 and 2000, he came away with that and still says this in speeches, that dental health disparities is a silent epidemic in our country. The hat I wear at Care Oregon is as the dental director. Care Oregon serves 180,000 Oregon Health Plan medical patients, is working with health share, as you described, to around healthcare reform, and serves 35,000 dental patients. Of the 180,000 patients last year, approximately, that Care Oregon served, 7% of the children 0 to 5 years old, 7% of that population got their dental care in a hospital operating room under general anesthesia because they were too young and their decay was too severe to treat in their traditional dental clinic environment that most of the people on this panel and on the city council enjoy for their dental care, the type of environment that we enjoy for our dental care. This morning in our clinic, we had a child. You know, I didn't see them, but one of my colleagues did in Oregon City, and they all end up in the hospital operating room because of these types of issues. When we look statewide, according to Healthy Smiles document, which was put out by the Oral Health Program and the Oregon Health Authority, 63% of the children in Oregon have experienced tooth decay, two-thirds. 35% have untreated tooth decay, 20% rampant decay. Again, rampant decay. And for those of us that see these types of patients in our practice, daily practice, we want everyone who is addressing this issue to see what this actually looks like and imagine their family member, their friend, their children having this as their oral health. 20% have rampant decay, and 4% have urgent needs. That means they're in pain. They have draining infections in their mouth while they're in school or while they miss school. And some of the later panelists will tell you about some of those numbers. We'll describe those numbers to you, missed school days, and other impacts that this issue has on families. And with the elderly population in our communities, there's effectively, unless they can get public transport or transport from a family or some kind to a dentist, whatever kind of clinic that may be, private, public, otherwise, then they just don't have care. I do my post-op checks after oral surgery procedures in nursing homes. I've been to Marquee more than 2 or 3 times in Oregon City and do other types of procedures there because it's too hard for a 90-year-old patient who's there to go through the trouble of coming to a clinic. And Lastly, another hat I wear is I teach courses in public health and policy at OHSU School of Dentistry. And when I develop those courses, I do a course on fluoride. I do a single lecture on fluoride, and we talk about it. It's talked about in other courses. And in that role, when I develop those lectures and my colleagues develop those lectures and base their opinion on and make up their opinion on community water fluoridation, we look to the most respected scientific bodies in our society. That would be Institute of Medicine, the CDC. Almost unanimously, every organized medical and advocacy group that deals with children and families, health, oral health, or otherwise, stands in support of community water fluoridation. There are some outliers, I understand that, and I respect their opinion, but the data simply speaks for itself, and the major organizations that look at this support it. And that's what I have to take into consideration when I'm talking to a group of dental students or to a patient or a family member or a colleague. I can consider all sides of a story, but I have to respect those bodies.
So keep going. Sorry.
And probably the most important hat that I wear that before you is one as a citizen of Portland, a citizen who, with his wife, chose this community to raise our family because of the unique way in which, in our opinion, Portlanders view community, consider the lives of others, the well-being of others. That's why we picked this community to raise our children. And both my wife and I can't speak for her. I can speak for her. She's not here. Encourage the city council to vote for community water fluoridation because it is the best thing to do for the oral health. It is a cornerstone of any comprehensive plan to improve the oral health of the citizens of Portland. Thank you.
So I have a follow-up question for you. So one of the cited studies continuously raised has been the University of Harvard study that was a meta study of studies in China, I believe, most of them in China. And had one of its conclusions that fluoride lowers the IQ. Now, my understanding is that fluoride in China is a natural occurring element in their drinking water wells. And my understanding is that it was at 11.5 parts per million, and Commissioner Leonard talked about ours is 7/10 parts per million. And that the study did not evaluate optimal water fluoridation, and it did not conclude that even higher levels of water fluoridation reduces IQ or harms brains. I wanted you to comment on this often cited study as reason not to support fluoridation.
Two statements. One is later panelists are going to speak in greater detail about that, I believe. My own opinion on it is that has been distorted and used as a fear tactic. Because, as you said, there were very specific things pulled out of that study, pieces pulled out of that study, and they looked at children in a vacuum throughout the study that whose water concentrations were 10 to 15 times that which is being proposed here, and it lowered the IQ over those particular groups half a point, and follow-up reviews of that have not been supportive. And have insisted that further studies would be needed to even consider that a valid basis.
But you understand how this has scared the heck out of a lot of people.
Yes.
Okay.
And I would not support water fluoridation at that concentration.
Right.
I don't think any major scientific body that's reviewed the evidence would.
Right.
So it's quite possible that at that percentage there is an effect. But that would be a public health issue, and I would support fully getting it to the optimal level.
And so. Thank you very much. Thank you all. The next four are Dr. Eli Schwartz, Dr. Ken Wright, Bill Moss, and Dr. Phil Wu. They'll be followed by Dr. Stacy Nicholson, Ing Elder Saspies, and I apologize, Inga, and then Katie Zuckerman, they'll be next. Dr. Schwartz?
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, push the button. Push the button in front of you.
Push the button.
Yeah, okay. You can just leave it on.
It's like United Nations, yes. Thank you, Mayor and Commissioners, for this opportunity to talk to you about water fluoridation, which is on the table. My role today is just to go through a number of the scientific bases for water fluoridation, how fluoride works, what it does to the teeth, and what it does to the rest of the body. Its effect on the teeth is really a chemical effect. In the mouth, we have an ongoing war going on between bacteria and the surrounding saliva, the tissues, and the fluoride enters this war on the good guy's side. In that it connects with phosphate and calcium and helps to create a hard layer on the surface of the teeth so that they become more resistant to the acid that comes from the bacteria and which is essentially the thing that creates the cavities in the teeth. It also remineralizes, which means that part of the teeth will actually be dissolved all the time. And when there is fluoride in the mouth, it helps to restore that balance, to help to harden the surface of the teeth so that they will be more resistant. And the final thing of the fluoride is that it enters the complex works of bacteria and essentially prevents them from being as harmful as they could be. The greatest protection of the ongoing fluoridation, like in community water fluoridation, is really when the teeth are developing. And the teeth that we have in our mouth now as adults really developed between birth and 8 years of age. And when we actually ingest fluoride during that period of time, it helps to strengthen the teeth while they develop. When we then have our teeth out in our mouth later on and the fluoride is in the environment, of the mouth, it helps in the way that I explained before so that there is this constant balance and regeneration of the hardening of the teeth so that we will be able to prevent the cavities development. I've been very conservative in here. I've said more than 100 studies have demonstrated the effectiveness of optimal fluoridation of community water. In a sense, it is hundreds of studies. Water fluoridation and the effect of fluoride on the teeth is really a truly American discovery because it really happened in the beginning of the 1900s when a dentist in Colorado detected some brown stains on the teeth of the people he was treating. And after several years of study, he found out that it had something to do with the water. This is what I'll get back to that in a moment, but what we today would call dental fluorosis, because the water fluoridation, the water content of fluoride in Colorado at that stage was very high. Maybe more than we have talked about part per million. So it was not like in China, but probably around 4 to 6 ppm in Colorado. It probably still is in those cities, in those communities. But it was from there that the connection was made to the effect of the fluoride. And since the 1930s to 1940s, when the Public Health Service took over the studies of this special relationship, there have probably been thousands of studies, not only in America, in Australia, in the UK, and the rest of the world, which have pointed out unisonly that there is this positive relationship between a reduction in the cavities in the mouth of children and adults and the level of fluoride in the water when it is at the optimum level. These are just mentioned here, the 4 recent studies that have been published, but there are also reviews that I'll get to in a moment. In Oregon, we really don't have large population studies that show the relationship. As the mayor pointed out before, there are a few cities. 24% or 27% of the population in Oregon live in cities that have fluoridated water, Beaverton among them, but also Florence in Lane County, and one of the other communities in Lane County, Oak Ridge, which does not have any fluoride. And when small children in Head Start programs are being screened for oral health. We have had some possibilities to get the data from these, and these are the four usual groups that children are divided into. And as you can see from this simple slide, the fluoridated community has most of their children in the blue pie component, which is called routine dental care, meaning that the children were supposed to come back to dental care. Nobody in the emergency part, and a very small part in the level 3 urgent care. Whereas in the non-fluoridated Oak Ridge community, a very large proportion, one-third of the children actually had either urgent or emergency care, something that Dr. Plunkett was just showing you. And it could very well be that this would be one of those children on the right side of the slide here. This is another place in Oregon, the Dalles and Hood River, where Dalles is fluoridated, but Hood River is not fluoridated. And some data from a few years ago. Can I push the button? I can.
Yeah.
A few years ago, this data was collected to show the hospital charges for severe cavities in those two communities done by some of the local dentists up in those communities. And they were starkly different, obviously. And the dental workers who work in those communities are quite aware of this difference. This is just a final slide to show this difference, which essentially reflects the same picture that we saw from Oak Ridge and Florence. What I need to tell you, and which you have probably been informed about as well, is that one of the side effects of fluoride or use of fluoride is what we call fluorosis. This was what essentially brought attention to fluoride as a relation to teeth in the first place. At the levels where we are working at this stage, 0.7 ppm as recommended by CDC, the fluorosis levels are supposed to be very mild or mild. And we are seeing an example of that on the left side of the slide with a very mild, from a normal perspective, you would say, I mean, you don't usually look at your fellow human beings like this, you know, kind of the lips drawn away and looking straight at the teeth. And this is really a dental work. So very often mild to very mild fluorosis would not really be noticeable for most people. And we know that it does not have any adverse health effects. And most of the discussion that we really have is, what would you rather look like as the one on the left or the one on the right, which is actually also adult teeth, not primary teeth or children's teeth, but adult teeth which have actually been disappeared almost by cavities. My final comment is really that water fluoridation has been proven to be more effective than any other community-oriented preventive measure. It is a primary prevention. It is a prevention method that is used prior to any disease coming. Any of the other programs that we can do in terms of fissure sealants or preventive fillings or anything like that as dentists is all trying to repair something that has already been damaged. And what we try to do with water fluoridation in the most cost-effective way is to ensure that our children and adults, for that matter, will never actually be able to get this disease as cavities, which are totally preventable. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Doctor. Dr. Kinwright.
Good afternoon, Mr. Mayor, esteemed Council.
I want to thank you for this opportunity. I want to thank you for this opportunity to come in and talk to you about this significant crisis that we all face together as a community, and explain why Kaiser considers this an important part of our social responsibility mandate to address. As a graduate of Harvard Dental School and Harvard School of Public Health, I take exception to the fact that oftentimes we attribute the right thing to do to data that is not accurate, it's sometimes distorted. Sensitive to the article that you spoke of, Mr. Mayor, I went back and read it 35 times. I'm an obsessive compulsive periodontist, what can I say? And doing that continued reading of that document, it was clearly evident, even the first time, was that the author, who I happen to know, explicitly said that the IQ level that was stated could have been a simple matter of measurement error. The fact that, as you noted earlier, that the fluoride levels were so high that you wouldn't even consider it as an optionable treatment protocol to be used in any community level. I believe, and Kaiser believes, that the safety, the effectiveness, and the affordability of communal water fluoridation has been documented globally by multiple organizations and experts all over the world. I'm not going to cite the documentation. Some of my those who will follow will do that. Needless to say that Kaiser supports this initiative because it's the right thing to do. Kaiser supports this initiative because it's our friends, it's our families, it's our children, it's our community. Kaiser supports this because it aligns with our mission to spread health, total health in the community. It aligns with our focus to prevent disease before it occurs, not to treat the ravages of disease afterwards when it becomes more expensive and quite a burden to the system, to our families, to the business community, to the government, and certainly to our healthcare delivery system, which is undergoing its current challenges about how do we fund, how do we provide resources necessary to address those most critical levels of disease. And for the bottom line, if more than anything else, the fact that every child deserves to smile. Every child deserves to smile and to thrive. We've talked before about the level of decay, the number of people, how the breadth of spread in the community. I can tell you, based on data I review, that about 70% of the patients that we see at Kaiser are patients who we have to either restore teeth due to caries or cavities or replace old fillings. 70% of the workload that we see. We know that studies have documented that a 10-year-old child that has a cavity, over the course of his or her life, it's going to cost that individual $2,000 to address that cavity, which could have been prevented. We simply can't afford to continue to do this, to fix things after they occurred, to elevate the level of burden on our community because of the cost of care that could have been prevented. And we're talking about every level. Employers, families, insurance rates are high. It's based on utilization. The more you use insurance, the higher it becomes. And we have, I was told, one of the lowest uninsured rates in the country of our family members. We talk about the ability to provide facilitated care to our children, the elderly, the sick, the poor, the uninsured. It's been quite a burden on everyone, including the healthcare system. Those who will follow will talk about the impact on emergency room visits. I think you've seen some of the studies that document the fact that most emergency room visits by the uninsured are due to dental disease. Typical cost for an emergency room visit might cost upwards of $1,000 that could have been for a care that could have been prevented or mitigated for a $100 dental visit if that member had access to care that they don't. It's our responsibility, our social responsibilities, advocates of change, protectors of our community, shapers of our future, to do something right and to do it right now. This is our moment of truth, to demonstrate that we care, that we are concerned, that we will make a difference. We can talk specifically about studies that have documented over the years, scientifically based, consistent, that are subject to the most explicit scrutiny in terms of scientific process, have documented that savings can result. There's a Colorado study that was produced in 2005 that looked at the level of benefit provided in Colorado. They documented that $149 million could be saved annually in treatment costs, in fillings and extractions, in root canals, in the 172 communities that had fluoridated water. In that study, they also said if the remaining 52 communities would adopt this plan, they would save an additional $56 million. That's significant. In New York, they documented that 32% of those members who were Medicaid patients who lived in fluoridated communities, 33% of those had less dental treatment than those who did not. It's a cost of about $23.65 for those that didn't. In the Texas study, they documented that $24 per child could be saved for Medicaid recipients for those members who lived in fluoridated areas. So the benefit is without doubt. It's documented. It's for public record. It's been seen. It's visible. I think studies, the CDC, I think in 2011 it was, documented that, and Mr. Mayor, you related to that, that about one and Commissioner Leonard, that $1 invested in fluoridation would save the city an estimated $38 in dental costs. And what does that mean for Portland? That means about $18.6 million a year in medical burden that could be relieved if we fluoridate our waters. For minimum, nominal startup costs for about $5 per citizen. $5. We're talking about a facility startup of about $5 million, I think, annualized over 25 years. That's about 11 cents a month per citizen to prevent the ravages, to reduce the needless suffering and pain and anguish that we see in our future. This is our future. These are our kids. These are our friends. This is our neighborhood. This is our defining moment to make a difference. Charles Dickens in A Christmas Carol once mused, "No amount of regret can make amends for a lifetime and opportunity loss." I believe that together, we, the community, can make a difference, that we can shape the future. I think communal public water fluoridation will make that difference. Every child deserves to smile, and every child deserves to thrive. This is our moment of truth. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Wright. Bill Moss?
Thank you, Mr. Mayor and Commissioners. I'm Dr. Bill Moss from Bethesda, Maryland. I'm an advisor. I'm an advisor to the Pew Children's Dental Campaign. And from 1998 to 2008, I was director of the Division of Oral Health at CDC. Next. As has been already mentioned, CDC identified fluoridation as one of 10 great public health achievements of the 20th century. And that was in recognition of the tremendous improvement in dental health that occurred since the widespread implementation of fluoridation beginning in the 1950s. It's now in use in more than 40 countries, reaching over 405 million people worldwide. Now, you may hear from opponents of water fluoridation that in the United States, fluoridation is in decline, and that hundreds of communities have declined or discontinued fluoridation during the past decade. Such statements are a distraction from the truth. The truth is that since 2000, about 42 million more people in the United States have received optimally fluoridated water than before. Data submitted to CDC by state health departments confirm that 204 million Americans now receive the benefits of optimally fluoridated water. Moreover, the proportion of the U.S. population served by water systems with optimally fluoridated water has increased over the past decade at the rate of about 4 million more people each year. And while there have been setbacks in various communities, the overall situation in the United States is one with more gains than losses, with an annual rate of increase that has actually improved during the last decade. In contrast, Oregon is one of only three states who provide less than 25% of its residents on public water systems with optimally fluoridated water. One of only three states. In the 40 states that provide optimal fluoride to 50% or more of their residents, even the residents of non-fluoridated communities benefit from the halo effect, which is the availability of fluoride in non-fluoridated communities by the diffusion of foods and beverages that were processed in the fluoridated cities. In Oregon, fluoridation coverage is too low to provide a halo of protection for hardly anyone. That would change, of course, if Portland were to fluoridate, as it would benefit not only the people of the Portland community directly, it would also provide at least some benefit to anyone consuming foods or beverages processed in Portland. Now, people often ask me, what is the one best study that proves fluoridation prevents tooth decay? Well, science doesn't work that way. Rather, we reach conclusions based on the weight of the evidence provided by several studies. And conclusions reached that way are considered to be robust. So our confidence in the effectiveness of water fluoridation comes from the systematic review conducted by the U.S. Task Force on Community Preventive Services. They reviewed 21 high-quality studies that tracked tooth decay in the same community over time and observed what happens when fluoridation was either started or when it was discontinued. Sometimes two communities were compared to one another, but only after the populations were matched carefully to rule out confounding factors. The review reported in 2001 focused on children. Later, in 2007, similar conclusions were reached by reviewing studies of water fluoridation's benefits for adults. Now, most people in this room have seen the long list of local and national organizations that have endorsed fluoridation, so I'm only going to provide quotes from a few of them. These are the organizations we trust to provide us guidance on a wide range of health issues, and we have every reason to trust what they say about water fluoridation, too. It's also important to recognize that your water operators are also guided by high professional standards, and they can be readily trained to provide the community with optimally fluoridated water, as noted in this statement from the American Water Works Association. Water fluoridation is simply the addition of enough fluoride to the amount already present in water to bring the concentration to a level optimal to prevent decay. Unfortunately, the internet is rife with misinformation about fluoride additives. So let's review a few facts. Fluoride exists naturally at some level in every water source. If we were salmon and swimming in the ocean, we'd be drinking water at over 1.2 parts per million of fluoride. But we're humans, we need fresh water. And the Bull Run water supply contains fluoride at a level of around a tenth of a part per million, which is quite typical of surface water sources. The optimal level, as been noted earlier, is to prevent tooth decay, is 0.7 parts per million. So how are we going to get the fluoride to the right dosage? Well, we'll add something to the water, just as we already do at the Bull Run water supply. In the late 1990s, opponents of fluoridation claimed that the fluoride compounds added to water acted differently than naturally occurring fluoride. And you may even hear such claims this afternoon. You should know, however, that in response to those claims, very sophisticated studies have been conducted in the United States and in England, which confirm that when the fluoride additive dissolves in the drinking water, it completely disassociates to free fluoride ions that behave in the body like any other fluoride ion. Fluoride additives used in the U.S. are very pure. Regardless of where they are manufactured, they must meet standards for purity. Batches of the product are tested to verify their purity. Reports from these tests confirm that most samples show no detectable contaminants. Those samples in which contaminants are detected have such low levels as to pose no risk. To put this in perspective, the typical cup of tea has 290 times as much arsenic as you would consume by drinking a glass of fluoridated water, and an apple has 250 times as much. In a few minutes, Dr. Wu is going to discuss the safety of water fluoridation. And other testimony you will hear today will also discuss safety, and many of the statements will draw from the 2006 report of the National Research Council. It's a very important report. Because fluoride can occur naturally in drinking water at high levels that could cause adverse health effects, the Environmental Protection Agency is required to regulate the safety of water. And it relies on distinguished independent organizations like the National Research Council to provide advice. I'm raising this issue now before Dr. Wu's presentation because I want to spend just one more minute describing the regulation of fluoride in drinking water before I turn the microphone over to him. The NRC report was commissioned by the EPA, which is responsible for assuring the safety of drinking water. Contrary to what you may have heard elsewhere, the EPA does not make recommendations about water fluoridation. This is the responsibility of the CDC within the Department of Health and Human Services. In January 2011, these agencies made a joint announcement to provide status reports of their respective roles. The joint announcement was intended to stress the fact that the agencies rely on the same body of scientific evidence. But I'm sorry to say that it's also resulted in some public confusion that I would like to clear up today. So if you look at the graph, drinking water sources in the U.S. have varying levels of fluoride, naturally occurring, ranging from near 0 to 10 milligrams per liter, represented by the blue bar. So if there were no regulations, depending on where one lived, they might have water with a fluoride level anywhere on that continuum. But for the past 30 years, the EPA has enforced a maximum contaminant level for fluoride of 4 milligrams per liter, which is the red bar. This means that communities that had water sources with higher levels of fluoride had to provide an alternate source of water. The EPA also had a secondary maximum level of 2, the green bar. That level was intended to protect children from severe dental fluorosis, which can occur at levels above 2. This means that communities are allowed to have water with fluoride levels above 2, but the parents in those communities are urged to provide an alternative source of water to young children during the tooth-forming years. Only 1 or 2% of the U.S. population is served by such systems. As noted earlier, almost 74% of people in public water systems in the U.S. have optimally fluoridated water, represented by the 0.7 milligrams per level that is now recommended by CDC, where natural levels are supplemented by just enough fluoride to bring them to the optimal level. That is a level well below the 2 milligrams per liter above which a parent might be concerned with severe dental fluorosis. The other 25% of the population, which includes Portland, has suboptimal levels of fluoride, which is associated with higher levels of dental decay. The 2006 NRC report was significant for the EPA because the NRC concluded that severe dental fluorosis was not merely a cosmetic effect, but was actually an adverse health effect. This was not a conclusion that severe fluorosis was becoming more common, only that new research had found that people with severe fluorosis required more dental restorations. Therefore, it was an adverse health effect. This finding has set the stage for the EPA to conduct further research, which it is now doing, to set a new maximum contaminant level goal, which is likely to be no higher than 2 and perhaps as low as 1.5. If you were among the 3 or 4 million people drinking water with fluoride levels between 2 and 4 parts per million, you might be very interested in what the EPA eventually concludes and whether it sets a new maximum contaminant level. But you aren't. The EPA action will have no effect on the Portland water system. Your choice is simply to continue to have a water system that provides suboptimal levels of fluoride, or whether you will supplement the natural level with pure additives that raise the level to one that is effective in preventing tooth decay. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Dr. Wu?
Thank you. I'm Dr. Phil Wu, pediatrician with Kaiser Permanente, and I'm also a director of the Northwest Health Foundation and Upstream Public Health. So you've heard a lot about the effectiveness of fluoride in the earlier discussions here, and I want to say a little bit more about the safety aspects. Next slide. So I want to piggyback on what Commissioner Leonard had said at the outset of this hearing, which is basically there isn't anything that you put in your mouth and swallow that won't potentially be toxic to someone under the right circumstances. And that's a very important concept to keep in mind. And so common things like salt, like vitamins A and D, which are present in a lot of the foods that we consume, iron, all of these have health benefits at appropriate levels and doses. But all of these can have adverse effects and potentially even be toxic at extremely high doses. I'll give you one example, potassium. Potassium is life-saving for certain heart problems. You know, some people even use potassium as a salt substitute. But potassium at extreme levels is life-taking. And the best example of that is lethal injection, which potassium chloride was used in several protocols. So here you have a balance between appropriate controlled doses that have benefits, and yes, at the other extreme, you have potential adverse effects. This is true for everything that we come in contact with. Next slide. Another general point I want to make is this whole issue of science and medicine. You know, thousands of studies are done annually all over the world on just about every topic you can possibly imagine. You know, the data that comes out is enormous. Most people, most healthcare professionals, myself included, don't have the training nor the time to systematically review all of these studies and be able to come up with appropriate interpretations. Okay. We leave that to experts. That's why we have credible, objective organizations that have experts that do this job of reviewing the studies and the data and offering consensus opinions on what we're supposed to do with all that information. It's not helpful. In fact, it's chaotic for individuals to take it upon themselves to try to review this mountain of data and then say, this is what it says. That's why we have organizations like the CDC, Institute of Medicine, ADA, U.S. Services Task Force on Community Health that do this kind of work. Next slide.
If I could interrupt you, you're doing great on the hand gestures. Someone that hissed up there, I'll have you removed. But the hand gestures are great and good exercise.
Okay. I want to come back
and
to
the person that just hissed, I'm really not kidding.
I want to come back to the National Research Council that has been referred to so far. This, again, was a very important review in 2006. This was not a study. This is a review of studies. Okay, and the important thing to realize here is that in evaluating fluoride levels, okay, they were looking at levels of naturally occurring fluoride, and with the goal of trying to set these levels of the maximum level that would be tolerable and what's called the secondary level of fluoride. So naturally occurring fluoride, this is a whole different issue from what we're talking about here, which is the optimal level of fluoridation for community water sources. Now, this review looked at everything, including all the potential health effects that you could possibly imagine, including neurological, intelligence, liver, kidney, bone, carcinogenicity, a number of effects. And the bottom line is, if there were any possible effects, these were noted at high levels of fluoride, well above what we are talking about in terms of the optimal levels of fluoridation. And the only conclusion that this, you know, National Research Council could come to was that severe dental fluorosis, you know, could occur at 4 parts per million, and their recommendation was, in fact, to lower that maximum level to somewhere below 4. And as Bill Moss referred to, the level that will eventually be ascertained has yet to be defined. Okay. We're not talking about what happens at levels at 1 or below, like at 0.7 parts per million. And finally, the National Research Council, you know, acknowledged that most communities have the optimal level of 0.7. Next slide. I want to come back to what Mayor Adams, you were talking about on this issue of intelligence. Because, you know, as a pediatrician, this is something that really kind of hits home. You know, pediatricians are concerned about neurodevelopment. And so what happens to a child in the formative years is really essentially the whole thing that we are concerned about. So I think, just as Eli had said, if there were any doubt about effects on intelligence in the brain, we would be the first to say fluoride's got to go. Okay. Now, both the NRC report in 2006 and the review that you had referred to, Mayor Adams, this one that was just published within a month or two ago by from Harvard, looked at this issue of intelligence. And it's important to realize that, again, this was looking at naturally occurring levels of fluoride in Asian countries. Their normal control level was 1 part per million. Okay, their normal control level. They were looking at populations that had fluoride levels as high as 11.5 parts per million, and those were the populations that they were comparing intelligence to. Okay, and so the difference of a point between their normal and their elevated Now, there are a whole number of issues that you could point to when it comes to the study design. You know, a lot of the IQ tests that were done are not the kinds of IQ tests that we would do in the United States. Right? The Ravens test is a test that measures pre-verbal intelligence, sometimes called fluid intelligence. This is intelligence that's not affected by what you learn. Now, pre-verbal or fluid intelligence is highly affected by maternal IQ, maternal nutrition. These were factors that were excluded and not controlled for in the vast majority of these Asian studies. So the study design makes all the difference in the world in what you can conclude on this kind of an issue. Next slide, please. There's been a lot of debate over the decades about fluoride and osteosarcoma. And I think all that we can really say is that, you know, in February of 2012, the National Cancer Institute position statement was, there is no association between fluoride and osteosarcoma. None. Okay, that should put to rest any ongoing question in this regard. Next. There's been a lot of discussion about infant formula and the fact that, you know, you're going to mix infant formula with fluoridated water, and that would be a problem. Well, as a pediatrician, I can say that breastfeeding is always the ideal form of infant nutrition. However, the American Academy of Pediatrics acknowledges that it is perfectly okay to mix infant formula with fluoridated water at optimal levels, and that is not an issue. Next slide. And then finally, there's this issue of toothpaste. You will hear that because there are product warnings on toothpaste, that that's an indication of fluoride toxicity. Well, first of all, toothpaste does contain 1,000 times more fluoride than what we would be talking about in fluoridated water. That's why we say children under the age of 6 should not use fluoridated toothpaste without parental supervision because of the issue of swallowing. Okay. However, product warnings are designed to prevent excessive intake. That's what they're there for. And there are other things in toothpaste that are also potentially a problem, notably sodium lauryl sulfate. Now, many of you, if you look at your bottle of bath gel or your bar of soap, will see sodium lauryl sulfate oftentimes as the second ingredient. This is a surfactant. This is what makes your bath gel bubble or makes your soap lather. Now, this is basically a pretty safe substance, but it does have significant skin irritation, and it has been known to cause the equivalent of what we would call canker sores. So the point here is that product warnings on toothpaste are not only directed towards excessive ingestion of fluoride, but also to everything else that might appear in toothpaste. So that concludes what I wanted to comment on about safety issues. I think just to kind of wrap up this panel, what I want to encourage you as city commissioners to do is that when you are making your decision, that you listen to authoritative, credible science, and you have sources of credible, authoritative science. We've mentioned them here numerous times. To do otherwise introduces uncertainty, inaccuracy, and misinformation into your deliberations.
Thank you. Thank you all very much. We appreciate it. So you can return to your seats. We've got folks that are going to be testifying that are far flung. So if we could list the first four con testifiers, but I got four more.
Oh, you do?
Yeah. But I just
we have some a couple additions from our partner agencies.
Oh, you do?
that I'd like to have come up as well.
But I'm still going to why don't you read the first eight pro and the first eight con, just if you're over in, we've got folks over like in the Portland building, so I just want to give them plenty of warning to wait in the wings. So the first eight pro, the first eight con, we'll go with the first four con when we're done with the invited testimony. So can you read those names, please?
Okay, the first four off of the support list are Mitra Ibrahimi, Eli Schwartz, Gerald Hiltz, and Bob Mendelson. And the first four off the oppose are Francis Quintomps Miller, Kelly Barnes, Rick North, and Kim Kaminsky.
So if everyone whose name was mentioned, if you're in the Lovejoy or Pettigrove room or you're over in the hearing room C, if you could come to the right, what would be the right-hand door, the south door of the chambers, we will facilitate folks coming in and out. Dr. Stacy Nicholson, Inga Alderzibas, there's a place reserved in hell for my mispronunciations. Dr. Katie Zuckerman and Carmen Rubio. Hi, Dr. Stacy Nicholson, would you like to please begin?
Yes, thank you very much, Mr. Mayor, and distinguished commissioners. I thank you for taking on this very important issue, and I'm very grateful for the chance to participate today. I am the chair of pediatrics at OHSU and the physician-in-chief at Dornbecker Children's Hospital. I'm speaking today on my behalf, but my positions also concur with that of OHSU. At OHSU, in both the School of Dentistry as well as at Dornbecker, we do have ways to treat dental illnesses. Particularly at Dornbecker, we have oral surgery and dentistry there that's co-located with the operating rooms so that anesthesia is readily available. But prevention is much better than treatment in everything, but in particularly in terms of dental issues. And water fluoridation is one of the best means for preventing tooth decay in children. Poor oral health, which you've heard a lot about today and about cavities, is not just about cavities.
Carla, do you have a slideshow going or no?
I do.
There, now. Ooh, now we have it. I don't want the system to crash again, but I want to see your slideshow.
Okay, thank you very much. So most of the previous presentations have been around oral health on its own, but oral health in children in particular is not just about cavities, but has an impact on other health as well. There are health consequences of oral health in terms of both chronic illnesses as well as acute infections. In children, acute infections resulting from poor dentition are particularly problematic, and dental abscesses have been associated with brain abscesses, endocarditis, or a bacterial infection of the heart, and clotting of major blood vessels in the neck, leading to blood clots traveling to the lungs. And in some cases, these are severe enough to require intensive care, and sometimes children have died. And we view those deaths as having been completely preventable. Also, at a hospital like Dornbecker, we treat children with cancer and other serious illnesses, and there are times when they come in with poor dentition, and those very important treatments are delayed because we have to deal with their dental illnesses first so that infectious complications of chemotherapy, for example, are lessened before we actually give the chemotherapy. Okay, the slideshow has stopped moving.
Really?
So the next slide is about anesthesia. As mentioned earlier, young children and children with a lot of dental caries, as well as children with developmental disabilities, cannot tolerate general dental treatment in a chair, as most of us would get, but have to undergo anesthesia. And recent information is showing that there are some long-term complications of anesthesia during childhood. And when you can avoid unnecessary anesthesia, that's also another benefit of improved oral health. As has been mentioned by previous, thank you. As has been mentioned by previous speakers, poor dentition is also a reason for emergency room care, and that's a leading cause of ER visits in children. This is a very bad place to get dental care. Typically, all that can be done at that point in time is antibiotics and pain medications, which doesn't treat the underlying problem for poor dentition. And each of these ER visits is both ineffective and also a waste of our resources as a society in taking care of these problems. Each cavity that occurs in childhood